From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how journalists covered the American Civil War. The New York Times coverage of the war has been collected in a new book called The Most Fearful Ordeal. We'll talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian James McPherson, who wrote the book's commentary. Then we'll talk about covering contemporary conflicts with Washington Post reporter Pamela Constable. She's based in Kabul and has covered wars and disasters around the world. She's written a new memoir about her work and the impact it's had on her life. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new reissue Black Christ of the Andes by pianist Mary Lou Williams. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A South Korean man held hostage in Iraq has been killed after negotiations failed to secure his release. His captors had demanded South Korea pull its soldiers out of Iraq. NPR's Emily Harris reports from Baghdad.
Kim Soon-il was fluent in Arabic. He had worked in Iraq for a year as a translator for a South Korean company whose customers included the U.S. military. He was kidnapped Thursday in Fallujah. On Tuesday, the U.S. military found the body of an Asian man, presumed to be Mr. Kim, and his severed head. A military official said it looked like the corpse had been thrown out of a car. Kim had begged South Korea to withdraw its troops from Iraq in a video that aired on television over the weekend. On the tape, he said he wanted to live. The South Korean government decided to stick with plans to keep nearly 700 medics and engineers in Iraq and send 3,000 more soldiers here later this year. Emily Harris, NPR News, Baghdad.
U.S. military officials say a precision airstrike in the Iraqi city of Fallujah today destroyed a safe house used by fighters loyal to Abu al-Zarqawi, said to be the top al-Qaeda operative in Iraq. They said it's the second attack on the terrorist network in 3 days. People in Fallujah say the strike actually hit a parking lot, killing 3 people and wounding 9. U.S. officials also said that insurgents killed 2 American soldiers and wounded a 3rd today in an attack on a convoy about 50 miles north of Baghdad. A car bomb went off in a residential area of Baghdad today, killing 3 people, including a 3-year-old girl. A U.S. military spokesman said 6 other people were hurt. A federal judge in San Francisco has given approval for a class-action lawsuit against Walmart. The suit could represent as many as 1.6 million women who have worked or still work for the discount retailer. Jason Lopez has more from San Francisco.
The complaint originated with women who alleged that they were doing the same jobs as men but making less. The suit also says Walmart has exhibited a pattern of preventing women from advancing to management positions. U.S. District Court Judge Martin Jenkins approved the class action status of the lawsuit after considering the merits of the case over the past 9 months. Now, as many as 1.6 million women, those who have worked for the retailing giant and those who currently work for it, can join in the suit. No date has been set for a trial. It represents the largest class action suit against a private employer in U.S. history. Walmart denies it has discriminated against women and says it will appeal the ruling. The company also says it recently changed its compensation structure for hourly employees. For NPR News, I'm Jason Lopez in San Francisco.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 23 points to close at 10,395. The NASDAQ was up 19 to 1994. This is NPR News. The White House has released a thick file of documents it says show the internal administration discussions about interrogation of inmates in military prisons. The administration says the documents from the White House, the Pentagon, and the Justice Department show that it did not condone torture of prisoners. Federal officials are bracing for a high volume of airport traffic this summer and say the number of airport screeners might need to be increased. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
More than 200 million travelers are expected to pass through the nation's airports this summer, a level that's higher than before the attacks of 9/11. But Congress has imposed a cap on federal airport screener jobs. Homeland Security Undersecretary Asa Hutchinson told the Senate Commerce Committee that his agency has been reassigning screeners to deal with increased traffic, but that other steps might be needed.
as we increase passenger load, as airports expand terminals, this simply demands more screening workforce, and I think it has to be continually evaluated by Congress.
Lawmakers are split over whether more money should be spent on hiring additional screeners. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
The Senate voted overwhelmingly today to increase fines for indecent programming on broadcast television and radio. The measure would raise the maximum fine from just over $32,000 per incident to as much as $275,000. The fines could pile up to as much as $3 million per day. The bill still needs to be reconciled with a House version that would boost the fines to $500,000 per violation. The legislation comes in response to viewer and listener complaints about nudity on television and offensive language on both TV and radio. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On April 15, 1861, the New York Times told its readers, "The darkest period in our nation's history has arrived." With the start of the Civil War, newspapers became more important than ever. A new book called The Most Fearful Ordeal collects the New York Times newspaper coverage of that war. It not only gives us an idea of how the battles were described in their own time, it shows the state of journalism in that era. My guest is historian James McPherson, who wrote the book's introduction and historical commentary. He's a professor of history at Princeton University and the author of several books about the Civil War, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning Battle Cry of Freedom. Here's a short reading from the beginning of George Smalley's report on the Battle of Antietam, which was written for the New York Tribune and was also published in the Times. Smalley was actually a volunteer aide for one of the generals at the battle.
"Fierce and desperate battle between 200,000 men has raged since daylight, yet night closes on an uncertain field. It is the greatest fight since Waterloo, all over the field contested with an obstinacy equal even to Waterloo. If not wholly a victory tonight, I believe it is the prelude to a victory tomorrow. But what can be foretold of the future of a fight in which from 5 a.m. till 7 p.m. the best troops of the continent have fought without decisive result?"
It wasn't easy for George Smalley to get his copy from the battlefield to the newspaper. James McPherson told me how Smalley did it.
"When it was over, he went to Frederick, Maryland, hoping that he could telegraph his report on what he saw to the Tribune. But the lines were tied up and he couldn't get through, and so he hired a locomotive to take him to Baltimore. He tried to get through from Baltimore and couldn't get through, so he took a train from Baltimore all the way to New York, stayed up all night long and all the next day, writing his article while he was riding on the train, and got into New York on the morning of the 19th, and exhausted, hadn't slept for probably more than 48 hours, turned in his article, and the Tribune published it on the 20th, and it is generally regarded as, and it's several thousand words, it's 5,000 or 6,000 words, it's generally regarded as the best example of Civil War reporting, and maybe one of the best from the 19th century.
What was the importance of newspapers for Americans during the Civil War?
Newspapers were really the only medium of communication for civilians in the Civil War. It's the only way they could find out immediately what was happening in the war. The telegraph had been invented about 15 years before the war, and during the 1850s, just about every part of the country was wired so that reporters could send in information from considerable distances to newspapers, and the War Department in Washington could get reports from far-flung army commanders and then give that information to the newspapers, so that unlike any previous war where there had not been telegraphic dispatches, people in Boston or New York or Chicago could read about military operations, great battles that had taken place just a day or two before.
News reports are often called the first draft of history. You point out in your notes in this book that the news reports were sometimes wrong. What's an example of that?
There was a tendency, and this was true of all newspapers on both sides in the war, especially in their first reports of a particular battle, to exaggerate the success of their own side, to minimize the casualties of their own side, and to maximize the casualties of the other side, a little bit like the body count statistics that many of us can remember from the Vietnam War and that we're actually seeing again sometimes in Iraq. A good example of that is the Second Battle of Bull Run, which was one of the most humiliating Union defeats at the end of August of 1862. And the initial reports sent in by the special correspondent of the New York Times talking about the Confederates in this battle writes, "They are in a country utterly barren of supplies and have been too busy to forage for them if the country did afford them. The rations they carried with them must be exhausted, and the opinion therefore begins to be suggested as probable in well-informed circles that today's battle," the battle was even then going on, "or at least tomorrow's, must exhaust their resources and compel either a surrender or a hasty retreat. Well, a northern reader reading that story would assume that the Confederates were on their last legs, that this was going to be a great Union victory, but then 2 or 3 days later the news comes that in fact it was a great Confederate victory and it's the northerners who are beating a hasty retreat. So here is a story that raises hopes high only when the truth finally comes in to dash them all the more severely.
Since the treatment of prisoners has been such a big news story in the news from Iraq, I thought I'd ask you to read a paragraph that was from a news item in July of 1861, and this is about the treatment of the wounded Union soldiers by rebels who captured them. And would you read this paragraph for us on page 84?
I surely will. "The treatment of our wounded by the rebels is reported as having been brutal to the last degree. Several soldiers assert that they saw them repeatedly draw their knives and cut the throats of our men as they lay upon the ground. Others stabbed them with their bayonets and inflicted every conceivable indignity upon them. In charging up the hill on the Warrenton Road, they set fire to the house used as a hospital for our men, some of whom escaped the flames by getting through the windows. A Massachusetts man passing a wounded rebel stopped and gave him water, but had not gone 5 rods when he saw him trying to stab another wounded man lying by his side. Such brutality would disgrace savages." Let me say about that, atrocity stories like this were fairly common on both sides in the early months of the war, when the war was a novelty, when the level of demonization of the enemy was at its highest. As the war went on, I think, and as it became clear that these early stories were quite exaggerated, there were far fewer atrocity stories. People were more realistic about that. And while the treatment of POWs on both sides in the war certainly left a lot to be desired, and there was a high mortality rate among prisoners, that was more often a consequence of disease and neglect rather than deliberate atrocities. And this reporter in this story is reporting what he's been told. For example, several soldiers assert that they saw them repeatedly draw their knives and cut the throats of our men. He's not necessarily reporting what he saw himself. What's important about it, though, I think, is that when people in the North read this, they believed it. At least at first they believed it. I think they became more skeptical and even cynical about reports as the war went on, but it did a lot to mold Northern opinion, and for that matter, similar stories in the Southern press to mold Southern opinion in the early months of the war, and probably, I think, had something to do with making this war more and more bitter, violent, more and more thorough as it went on. The Civil War started out as a war merely to suppress an insurrection, a kind of police action. And as time went on, and as casualties on both sides mounted, and as the stakes for both sides grew larger and larger, the war became far more bitter, far more violent, far higher number of casualties. And I think these early atrocity stories probably had something to do with that.
Do you think the Civil War changed journalism?
It did change journalism. It gave a much higher profile to reporters and to reportorial journalism than had existed before that time. If you take a look at newspapers, even as late as the 1850s, They consist of shipping news, some financial news, short stories that are continued from one issue to another, unimaginative advertisements, a lot of editorials and editorial correspondence, but relatively few news stories of the kind that we're familiar today with today. The war really brought journalistic reporting into or at least toward the modern age. It came of age as a consequence of the war. I think there's no question about that.
My guest is historian James McPherson. He wrote the introduction and commentary for the new book, The Most Fearful Ordeal, a collection of the New York Times coverage of the Civil War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning historian James McPherson. He wrote the introduction and commentary to a new book collecting the New York Times reports on the Civil War. It's called The Most Fearful Ordeal. You know, one of the things that interested me in these reports reports from the New York Times is that included in the reports from reporters, there's also reports from generals. You know, verbatim, it's their report. It's not folded into an article. It's just a dispatch from a military leader. In fact, I thought I'd ask you to read one because we don't read anything quite like this in newspapers anymore. I'm going to ask you to read a dispatch from General Hooker on page 184.
Let me preface that by saying that, in fact, much of what was reported as the initial information from the battlefield were telegrams sent from the front to the War Department and then passed along by the Secretary of War to the Associated Press, which was then as now a consortium of newspapers to pool information. And so you're quite right that much of the initial reports of fighting came from the front itself. And here is a report from General Hooker from Maryland on September 17th, 1862, which of course was the day of the Battle of Antietam. "A great battle has been fought, and we are victorious. I had the honor to open it yesterday afternoon, and it continued until 10 o'clock this morning when I was wounded and compelled to quit the field. The battle was fought with great violence on both sides. The carnage has been awful. I only regret that I was not permitted to take part in the operations until they were concluded, for I had counted on either capturing their army or driving them into the Potomac. My wound has been painful, but it is not one that will be likely to hold me up. I was shot through the foot." That's entirely accurate. Even an historian who knows about the battle can say that Hooker was telling the whole truth in that very short dispatch.
And it's a really interesting dispatch, and something different than what we see in newspapers now, since, you know, military dispatches aren't printed verbatim like that. It's a very different description of the battle than a reporter filed. And I thought I'd ask you to read a description of Antietam, which was one of the worst battles of the war. Before you read this description, why don't you just describe why Antietam was so important?
The Antietam was fought in September 1862 when the Confederates were on a roll, and it was an invasion of Maryland by Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia that was happening at the same time that another Confederate army was invading Kentucky. And these dual invasions were hoped in the South that it would knock the North out of the war, that it would achieve British and French recognition of the Confederacy, that it would undermine the Lincoln administration in the fall congressional elections of that year. And so the Northern victory in that battle was really reversed the momentum toward Confederate victory in the fall of 1862, and it was one of the first major turning points in the war that led ultimately to Union victory. It was also the single bloodiest day in all of American history. It was a one-day battle with about 23,000 casualties, 6,000 of them killed. And on no other day in American history have so many Americans been killed. Here's the description by the reporter, and it's really quite eloquent. Late last night and early this morning, I visited the scene of the most deadly conflicts during the battle yesterday and examined particularly the plowed field where Hooker's, Sedgwick's, and Banks's troops in turn contended against the rebel hosts, and the side hill, the cornfield, and the road where French's left was repulsed, and where Richardson's division gained so signal a triumph, and Mahar's, Caldwell's, and Brooks' brigades made such terrific slaughter in the enemy's ranks and gained imperishable renown. The dead and wounded were strewn upon the places indicated in hideous confusion. Here was a perfect winnow of butternuts and graybacks, these were Confederate soldiers, interlanded with Uncle Sam's bluecoats. At another point, the dead and wounded rebel and Union troops were in heaps, as if designedly placed so for a funeral pyre or an auto da fe, without the combustible material. And everywhere could be seen stern, unmistakable evidence of the desperate struggle which always characterizes civil war among the whole human family, be it between a savaged or civilized people. Here was the pile made by Kirby's battery. There was a heap by Thompson's and Hazard's grape and canister, when the real leader, maddened to desperation by the exigencies of the hour, hurled his massed columns upon certain destruction. Scattered here and there were groups of blackened corpses, indicating but too plainly the deadly certainty with which the German New York battery hurled its thunderbolts from the hill east of the Antietam. Mangled humanity in all its ghastly forms could be seen upon this field. To the left, to the right, behind and before, on every hand the eye beheld the horrors of the field. Mingled with the dead came up to the ear the groans of those in whose breasts there yet remained a spark of vitality, but whose lamp had nearly expired. The hopeful cases, so far as possible, were removed for medical assistance before midnight of Wednesday. The hopeless cases were allowed to remain upon the field. Some in a perfectly conscious, others in a half-conscious state, while more were insensible to all worldly affairs. One of the latter class, a rebel soldier, while we were walking over the field at night, vainly attempted to rise. He had received a wound upon the temple from which the brain protracted. He clutched at the air, and a helping hand was extended to him, and words of sympathy were spoken, but no sign of recognition followed. And in a moment more, the helpless victim fell over upon his face and was numbered with the dead. God grant that we may never witness another such scene.
This collection of the New York Times coverage of the Civil War also includes coverage of the assassination of President Lincoln, and it includes coverage of the execution of John Wilkes Booth's co-conspirators who were hanged. And those co-conspirators included a woman. Was it very unusual to have a woman hanged?
It was extremely unusual, and therefore it was highly controversial at the time and has remained so ever since in historical literature. There were debates at the time and have been debates since then about the degree of Mary Surratt's guilt as part of the conspiracy. She certainly knew what was going on in the plot to kidnap President Lincoln, which preceded the plot to assassinate him. Her son, John Surratt, who escaped, was very close to Booth, and she was also close to Booth, so she probably knew more than her defenders have conceded. But whether she should have been hung, she was mostly an accessory before the fact, I guess you might call her, and the punishment may have been too severe, but the fact that she was a woman made it even more controversial, because as far as I know, no woman had been hung before this time in American history.
There's an actual description of the execution that was printed in the Times. I'd like you to read that, because I think it's just very interesting to hear this document.
All right, here is the description from the Times. General Hartranft read the order of the War Department embracing the President's executive order for the execution. The limbs of each of the prisoners were now pinioned. The caps were drawn over their heads, Mrs. Surratt exclaiming in a faint voice, "Don't let me fall. Hold on." Adzerott exclaimed in a loud tone, "Gentlemen, take warning." Then, after an interval of about 2 minutes, he said, "Goodbye, gentlemen who are before me. May we all meet in the other world. It was now 25 minutes past 1 o'clock. The officer in charge of the scaffold here made some preconcerted motions to the attendant soldiers to step back from the drop. And then, with a motion of his hand, the drop fell and the bodies of the criminals were suspended in the air. The bodies fell simultaneously and swayed backward and forward for a few minutes. Mrs. Surratt appeared to suffer very little. Payne and Harold, on the contrary, writhed in apparent agony, the first for about 2 minutes, and the later for about 5 minutes. The muscles of their feet and hands were visibly contracted. Payne's hands, which were more exposed than the others, became purpled, as did his neck near where the rope was fastened. Adzerot's agony seemed, like Mrs. Surratt's, to be of but very short duration.
In the war in Iraq, the military encouraged anyone who was reporting on the war to apply to be an embedded reporter as opposed to just going off on their own. What was the military's reaction during the Civil War to the reporters covering the battles?
That varied enormously from one commander to another. There was no centralized policy on this in the case of the Civil War as there has been in more recent wars. And some military commanders welcomed reporters, especially if the reporters would write flattering things about them. Others hated reporters. Most notably in that area, in that respect, was General William Tecumseh Sherman, who barred reporters from his units, drove them out if they tried to sneak in. When he heard once that a reporter had drowned on the Mississippi River, turned out not to be true, but when he first heard that, he said, now we'll have news from hell before breakfast tomorrow morning. That represented his opinion of reporters. General Meade, after reporters in 1864 had written something unflattering about him in the Wilderness Overland Campaign, banned reporters and... from then on, the reporters all agreed that they would never mention his name favorably in any of their newspaper articles. So this varied from general to general.
Well, James McPherson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
James McPherson is a professor of history at Princeton University. He wrote the introduction and commentary for the new book, The Most Fearful Ordeal, a collection of the New York Times coverage of the Civil War. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Atlantic Monthly, prying open this year's presidential debates, former speechwriter James Fallows presents an in-depth guide on newsstands and at theatlantic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Washington Post reporter Pamela Constable. She's based in Kabul and is recently reported from Iraq. She's written a new memoir about covering wars and natural disasters and how that's affected her life. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue by Mary Lou Williams. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After reporting on the Taliban regime, my guest Pamela Constable is covering the attempts to build a democracy in Afghanistan. In April, she was embedded with a Marine regiment in Fallujah. She's covered South Asia for the Washington Post since 1999. She's also covered conflicts and natural disasters in Chile, El Salvador, and Cuba. In her new memoir, Fragments of Grace, My Search for Meaning in the Strife of South Asia, she admits that she's lived an extraordinary life, but she also reflects on the costs of that life, the things she has not had, like a real home and family. Constable is in the U.S. for a few weeks before returning to Afghanistan. We spoke yesterday.
As you see that there have been more beheadings, what goes through your mind? Do you feel like you're in, that you've gone back in time to another century when these things were common?
It's a particularly gruesome and barbaric kind of behavior. It's calculated to send, you know, a very, very strong message of real hatred and vengeance. It's funny that you should think about, mention going back in time. I mean, I live in Afghanistan, a country where barbaric forms of behavior towards one's enemies have been practiced up until very, very recently, including the Civil War. And after the Civil War, you had a regime in place that used barbaric methods of punishment, including executions and stonings and amputation of limbs. So this is something I've actually been working in an environment of for a number of years. And obviously it's a terrible thing, and it's strange to most people. But at least in Afghanistan, which is struggling to begin a very fledgling democracy from basically zero, you know, there's a whole legacy of violence and vengeful retaliatory violence that the country is trying to overcome even as we speak.
Are you the one who seems strange in an environment like that, strange for not comprehending that chopping off an arm is a just punishment?
Well, I should distinguish between, you know, past and present a little bit. I worked in Afghanistan a number of times during the Taliban regime. I was there 10 times. And yes, I felt extremely strange, you know, for a variety of reasons. One, being a woman on the street, which was absolutely unheard of. Often you'd walk down the street and you wouldn't see a single Westerner, let alone another woman. And then being a journalist was very strange there because there weren't any. So for a whole variety of reasons, not to mention being, you know, Christian in an extreme Islamic regime, I always felt very odd, and I tried my best to sort of fit in or make gestures or pretend. I always wore very, very baggy clothing, for example. We were not required to cover our faces because, you know, only Muslim women were required to cover their faces, but we did have to cover everything else as shapelessly as possible. So, you know, I did try hard, but, you know, automatically everybody who saw me knew that I was a complete oddity, and I would just have to forge ahead and try to do my job.
In your book, you mentioned that in Kabul there were, and I can't remember whether this is during the Taliban regime or after that, that there were very few public restrooms in all of Kabul and only two in all of Kabul for women. Was that before or after during or after the Taliban?
That was during the Taliban. Since then, many, many hotels or restaurants and public accommodations have been built, and it's completely different on that score. But there were a number of times in Kabul before the Taliban fell where, you know, you really had to plan your whole day around whether you'd be able to get to a certain restaurant, the only restaurant that actually allowed women inside and even had a bathroom for them as well. And even now, if you're crossing the desert or you're crossing, you know, a long road, I mean, there are very, very few bathrooms throughout this very rural and poor society. So one becomes quite shameless and adept at adjusting to that situation.
Well, that's such a great paradox. I mean, you mentioned that you would kind of find a hidden place in the ruins in Kabul, but, you know, it's such a paradoxical situation because it's the whole sense of modesty that forbids women to be in the street or forbade women from being in the street, and that, you know, accounted for the lack of restrooms.
and it kind of forces you to behave in a very shameless way.
That's true. Although for better or worse, yeah, the Taliban always treated us like honorary men when we were there.
Mm-hmm. Who are the greatest security threats coming from now, and just like regular safety threats? Is it from terrorists, from former warlords, private militias, common criminals?
There's not a huge amount of common crime. Basically, the two other sources you mentioned, you have these revived Taliban fighting forces and various allies and extremist groups that operate along the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, which is a very difficult, rugged, porous area, very hard to patrol or control. And they primarily attack individuals, aid workers, others in rural areas of the south and southeast. You have an entirely different problem in the north and west, where you have other militias which are allegedly allied with the government and allied with Western interests, but who are trying to make sure they keep a grip on the kind of power they've had over their regions for a very long time. So their threat is more of intimidation and abuse, extortion, putting pressure on the populace, vendettas and feuds, whereas the threat from the revived Taliban in the south and their allies is really more of a serious terrorist threat. So the situation is quite serious, but I should add that it's limited to certain areas. They certainly do not control the country or even a large part of it.
Afghanistan is preparing for an election. Are the former warlords cooperating with the elections, and are they negotiating for power in return for cooperation?
Well, that's what's been happening with some of the big ones. When I was last in Afghanistan several weeks ago, there had just been this round of talks, very controversial round of talks between the president and some of his emissaries and some of these big militia leaders. And they had reportedly agreed that they would not field a unified candidate against him. But that has been a very controversial development because, you know, there are sort of two versions of history in the Afghan public's mind. There is the version of history that is put forth by the militia leaders that, you know, we were great warriors, we helped the world defeat the Soviet Union, we brought them down with our Stinger missiles, and we deserve, you know, an honored, revered place in history forever and ever, not to mention a nice share of power and money. The other version of history is that these same people were responsible for this vicious civil war that destroyed Kabul and displaced many, many people, killed many, many people in Afghanistan during the early 1990s. And that's the way they're remembered by many people who think they should have no part in public life, no role, no honored place at all. Karzai has continually said he believes in the bringing them inside the tent philosophy, better than having them outside the tent shooting in. And that's the way he's approached it. But it has been a very criticized approach.
Would you say that there's truth in both of those historical readings?
I would. I mean, these were America's heroes in the 80s. You know, they were the rugged mujahideen who fought with plastic sandals and in freezing cold, wearing cotton robes and up in the mountains, and you know, shot down Russian helicopters. And you know, they were the heroes of the Reagan era. It was just astonishing to see these same people, you know, completely change their spots and to see what happened after the Russians left. And you had basically sort of chaos and mayhem and horrendous conflict among these militia leaders that they literally destroyed the capital of Kabul. I mean, until very recently, there's been a lot of building in Kabul in the last year and a half. But for the first year after the Taliban left, you could drive through Kabul and it literally looked like Dresden. It looked like, you know, Warsaw. It looked like a city after World War II that had not changed at all. It's the strangest, surreal, most place to live. Now it's gotten much more bustling and lively. There's money coming in. There's internet cafes. There's cell phone shops. It's very quickly catching up with the world, which is exciting to see, although it's a pain in the neck, since that now you can't get across the street without being hit by a taxi. But that's better than having no taxis at all.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Pamela Constable. She's the Kabul bureau chief for The Washington Post, and she's written a new memoir about her life as a foreign correspondent. It's called Fragments of Grace, My Search for Meaning in the Strife of South Asia. Let's take a break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pamela Constable, and she's the Kabul bureau chief for The Washington Post. She's written a new memoir called Fragments of Grace, My Search for Meaning in the Strife of South Asia. You've lived an extraordinary life covering trouble spots around the world, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Cuba, Chile. You write in your book about traveling around the world. You also write in your book about the costs of this extraordinary life that you've led. What are some of the costs?
Well, the main cost, that really prompted me in many ways to write the book, was I realized that in traveling, you know, so far and wide to sort of find all these exotic places and cover these strife and turmoil and come to grips with the struggles of distant peoples and societies, that I really had neglected my own family, my own friends, my own life. I missed, you know, every family wedding, every family funeral. You know, I regret that. I mean, obviously, the other big issue was, you know, having children. I never had children, and that's because I was on the move, and I wanted to keep going, and I wanted to be sharp and fresh and mobile and agile and all those things that a journalist needs to be. And I really was afraid of losing that.
Well, it seems to me, though, that from moment to moment, you probably didn't want that more secure, anchored life of home, family, children, with all the responsibilities as well as all of the pleasures that one gets from that life.
Well, that's right. As I said, I was always sort of on the move. I mean, I've been through periods of time. I have been married in the past. I have had houses in the past. I've had sort of semblances or periods of normality in my life. But it never lasted in the sense that I always wanted to go off and do something else. I was never really ready to settle down within myself. Was never really ready to settle down. And I always felt like, I don't know. I felt as if I could, the places I was needed or the places I could do something of value were not home. And I'm still not convinced that that was a right decision. But as I say, I don't regret it. And I do think and hope I have added something of value. You know, I have a part in the book where I talk about, I have a very, very close friend. And, you know, while I was off in some horrible place, she was having a baby. And so there's a parallel there. You know, she stays up at dawn with a colic and I'm up at dawn because I'm trying to catch a plane. You know, we've had these sort of parallel but very, very different experiences. And it's something we talk about often.
You also have a friend, Elizabeth Newfer, who was killed in Iraq shortly after the official fighting ended, and she was killed in a car accident on the highway. She wasn't driving. She had a driver then. She reported for the Boston Globe. It sounds like you were pretty close and that you used to compare notes a lot because you led similar lives. You were similar in age. You were close in age. How did her death affect your view of the decisions you made in your life and the dangers that you were continuing to expose yourself to?
It affected me a lot. You know, when she died, I had already finished my book, and it really made me think a lot and feel a lot. And I ended up rewriting the entire epilogue of the book to be about her and to reflect on even more on some of the choices I had made and she had made. And you know, we understood each other's compulsions and each other's sort of idealism and what it was that drove us to do these difficult assignments and to be far from the people we cared about who cared about us. I sat down to write the book partly because I was in an incident where four of my colleagues were killed in Afghanistan in 2001. So that sort of theme of it could have been me really runs through the book and runs through a lot of what I've been thinking about. In the past several years, I've known a number of people who've been killed now, some close, some acquaintances, some not people I knew at all, but people I'd met once. Who've been killed in covering or being in part of the conflict that I've been working on for the past number of years. And it adds up, that feeling of horror adds up, and that feeling of, you know, is it worth taking that risk also adds up. And I think Elizabeth's death brought it probably closer to home than any other that I had experienced.
How were your four colleagues killed in Afghanistan?
We were driving in a convoy. The Taliban had just fallen, and we were all driving in a convoy. We had come across the border from Pakistan after a great deal of difficulty, and we were driving toward Kabul in a convoy of, I don't know, eight vehicles or something. But it was a sort of a spread-out convoy. It wasn't like a military convoy. We couldn't really necessarily see the next car. And this was just around Thanksgiving of 2001. All of a sudden, we saw this cloud of dust, and this taxi in front of us was spinning around and came back towards us, racing towards us. And we looked, and there was the driver, and there was no one in the car. And the driver was screaming at us to follow him. So we all turned around and followed him. And we finally got to a gas station and stopped, and he was crying, and he was hysterically trying to explain what had happened in the Pashto dialect. And gunmen, possibly Taliban, renegade Taliban, had flagged down the taxi at gunpoint, had pulled out the two passengers, and had shot them dead. And this happened with a second taxi that was following it. And they were just too far ahead for us to see when it happened. But it was, you know, that was awful. And one of the people who was killed was someone I knew quite well. From Pakistan, and it turned out I was the only person in this whole group that knew him, and so I had to identify his body in the morgue the next day, and that really was shocking because he was a very jovial, sort of wisecracking, cheerful guy, a photographer from Reuters, and I'd known him. And the night before, we were sitting in our hotel cracking jokes, and he was helping me with my computer, and we were laughing. And I saw him in the morgue. He just looked like a piece of stone. He didn't look like a human being at all. And I just thought, oh, my God, you know, maybe 100 yards closer, 100 yards further down the road, and this would be me.
Did you write about this for the Washington Post?
I did. I wrote a piece for the Outlook section, which was, in fact, the genesis of this book, and it is the prologue of the book as well.
So you were able to write in a first-person kind of way about the experience.
I did, but it was very difficult. They kept sending back the piece and saying, we want more of you, we want more of you.
It really, because it's interesting. I guess it's because it's the Outlook, the magazine part, you know, as opposed to, because in the news section, they might be saying, we want less of you.
Well, in the news section, I was very careful. In fact, in my book, I describe that whole incident, you know, and I describe sitting down to write the story, and I couldn't even type the words. You know, it was so dispassionate and so objective and so removed. I didn't feel like anything, it didn't feel like me at all. And that's why I was very glad I had the chance to actually sit down and write something for Outlook a week later, because I was able to actually say a bit more about how it affected me and the rest of us. There were 40 of us in that hotel when this happened, and it was, you know, sort of sent this incredible chill through the whole press corps.
Now, your book ends with you being summoned by your paper to go to Iraq, and before you go, you call a contractor and ask the contractor, who's a friend of yours, a carpenter, to build an addition to your cottage that you live in, with a reading nook and a music den, kind of like preparing to have more of a stable physical home to return to. What's the status of that now?
I spent my first night there last Saturday. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I've kept the house all along. I've had friends staying there. I've had a menagerie staying there. I almost always bringing stray dogs and cats back, and people keep taking care of them for me. But it was just really nice. I do feel more solid. I feel like I've been on the road for so long, and my life has been in boxes for so long that it just feels really nice to maybe put down a few roots and spend a little time in my garden and unpack a few of my mementos that most people keep on their coffee tables. So I'm looking forward to that.
Thank you so much for talking with us, and good luck with your work and your life.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks. Pamela Constable covers South Asia for The Washington Post. Her new memoir is called Fragments of Grace, My Search for Meaning in the Strife of South Asia. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new reissue of Mary Lou Williams' recording Black Christ of the Andes. This is Fresh Air. Pianist Mary Lou Williams established herself in Kansas City in the 1930s, composing for Andy Kirk's 12 Clouds of Joy and playing on all-night jam sessions. Later, she moved to New York, where she arranged for Duke Ellington and Dizzy Gillespie and played with newfangled beboppers. After that, she got religion, and her music took another turn. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Williams is one of the rare jazz musicians whose concept kept evolving over decades. He reviews a Mary Lou Williams reissue from the early 60s.
Mary Lou Williams, circa 1962, showing off the floating sense of time that helped make her a great jazz pianist. My Blue Heaven is a fitting vehicle for her. It came up in the 1920s, as she did, and in later years, the blues and heaven were never far apart for her. Williams became a devout Catholic in the 1950s, and before long she was mixing religious subjects with secular music. Her Anima Christi is a prayer in blues form, supported by dense vocal harmonies and a dancing waltz beat. It gave new meaning to the term soul jazz.
Soul of Christ, be my sanctification.
Help, help.
Body of Christ, be my salvation.
Help, help.
Blood of Christ, fill my veins. Water of Christ, side wash out my stains.
Help, help.
Passion of Christ, my comfort be. Oh, good Jesus, listen to me, Lord, have mercy on me.
In your Jimmy Mitchell on vocals. This music comes from an expanded reissue of a 1964 Folkways LP titled Black Christ of the Andes, referring to the 17th century Peruvian saint Martin de Porres. He's the subject of a short cantata performed here by the Ray Charles Singers. Mary Lou Williams always had an open mind, boasting that no one can put a style on me. She befriended hip young pianists Thelonious Monk and Herbie Nichols when they were unknowns, and from a distance inspired avant-garde piano king Cecil Taylor. You can hear her kinship with those mavericks on her blues, Cool Bunga. The CD, Black Christ of the Andes, is divided between Mary Lou Williams' spry combo pieces and ambitious choral works. Jazz arrangements for harmonized voices tend to be pretty dismal, either bland as Muzak or tacky as Manhattan Transfer. But Williams, with one foot in the cathedral and the other in a nightclub, balanced those opposing forces with a heroic command of her materials.
The devil never rests, come day, come dusk, come dawn. You compromise and wind up soul in pawn. So don't it strike you funny when you look him in the eye? The devil looks a lot like you.
Maybe Mary Lou Williams could pull off something like The Devil because she practiced as well as preached. Back in the 60s, she ran a Manhattan thrift shop, which helped fund her efforts to rehabilitate musicians with addiction problems. For her, playing and praying and good works were inextricably linked. That helps explain why her diverse musical activities don't sound like postmodern style shopping, but like the emanations of one complex personality. She did it all and did it blessedly well.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Sun-Times, The Absolute Sound, and Downbeat. He reviewed Black Christ of the Andes by Mary Lou Williams on the Smithsonian label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Nonesuch Records, featuring A Ghost Is Born, the new album by Wilco, available at all Barnes & Noble music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This week, the U.S. is participating in six-party talks in the hopes of freezing North Korea's nuclear programs and restarting inspections. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jack Pritchard, who worked on North Korea issues in the Clinton and Bush administrations. He resigned from the Bush administration last August and has criticized the administration for lacking an effective strategy. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.